T-minus 25 seconds. 20 seconds and counting. T-minus 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Zero, all engine running. Liftoff, we have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Tower cleared.
Here, we got a roll program.
And as Apollo 11 does its roll program, this podcast now does its roll program. The tape is rolling. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. My name is Grant Cameron, and you're listening to the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. Thank you for taking time from your life to be here.
Hello, it's Grant Cameron, and I want to welcome you to the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast and YouTube. Tonight, my guest is Cheryl Costa, who is a longtime UFO researcher. We'll be speaking at the upcoming Contact in the Desert event, running from June the 25th to the 28th. And I have her on here to talk about a new book that she has out on UFO sighting data. And we get into a number of conversations as well about consciousness, about flying the craft, about religious implications, kind of this stuff. I cut off the beginning of the podcast in the video earlier, so I'm going to join the conversation already in progress. Enjoy this. It's a very enlightening interview.
And a considerable cleanup involved, but crunch their data and produce statistics. And Linda and I were coming at this whole UFO study thing from the idea of the numbers, doing statistical analysis, and that drew a lot of interest. So and of course I wrote a newspaper column, so I always had to have something to write about. The statistics gave me some fun stuff to work with, and that was the main point of doing it. And then I've been updating the database the last few years. And right up, and the numbers were going into the toilet. 16, 17, that 18 bottomed out, you know, and everybody was complaining. Peter Davenport was saying, "Oh my God, what's happened to all the UFOs?" You know, and I kept trying to tell everybody it's part of a normal trend because we had been studying the trend, and it's about a 6 to 8 year cycle, up and down kind of thing. And, I told them it was going to start coming back a little bit. 18 MUFON started tweaked back just a little bit in 18, 19. It came up a little bit. And then I took 2019 off to work on another project.
Yeah.
And around February, early March of 2020, I got a phone call from George Knapp telling me his phone's been ringing off the hook. There's UFO sightings all over creation right now. Is this a year to coming back? And I went out to New Fork data and pulled the first 3 months, January, February, March. And I stuck them into a template that I had. And right off the bat for that first quarter, it was the best year we'd had since 2014, which was a solid year. And I'm going, whoa, what's going on? So I told him, I says, give me a couple of days. You know, so I stuck the numbers into a model I had built. And I predicted where we would be this year, and we came out with really good numbers. In over a 20-year span, I predicted that we were going to come within 2% plus or minus a certain number. It was 2% of plus or minus like 167,000, and that's exactly what we did. We came at 167,632 sightings over 20 years, and that was a plus or minus 0.02. And it was really cool. So I started tinkering on it back in 2020. Wasn't anything else to do but watch streaming TV and eat, right? You know. So one of the problems we had, we wanted to do a statistical book on just shapes. we were going to do a 5-book set and analyze certain classes of shapes. Take the everything that's a square or a rectangle. Take everything that's circular or sphere. Take everything that's a wedgie, triangle, chevron, all those kinds of things. Take all the exotic that don't fit descriptions things and do 5 separate books and just break down all the data for them. Problem was, people have been pestering me for, can't you take it down and show us how many? You gave us the states, you gave us the counties. Can't you take it down to the city level and tell us how many we've had locally? And the problem was upwards of about 17% of the data, 3.5% of data, nobody entered in what the city was. Nothing. Or they put some snarky remark in there. Okay. Mom said not to tell you. The sheriff told me not to tell you. My dad spanked me, told me not to tell you, you know, that kind of thing. But that 3.5% left a big hole. It turned out to be about 4,000 sites, over 4,500 sightings.
Okay.
But 17% of the sightings, the name of this location or municipality was spelled wrong.
That's incredible.
Either all caps, lowercase, they put a space in front of it, or they put some additional minutia in there that says, you know, oh yeah, it was in Franklinville, right across from Joe's Bar, you know. And of course, the data doesn't pick it up. The data source won't pick it up. You know, won't even pick it up. That also blew our automation that we had built ourselves. We built a lot of algorithms to work with the data, and it blew it away because it said, it would see it and it wouldn't insert the county data because National UFO Reporting Center doesn't collect it. MUFON did, but it was dependent upon the observer, and 9 times out of 10, they didn't know where they were. Okay. So when we did our book originally, we got county lists and started comparing it. It took forever because we were doing it manually. We now have automated methods for doing it, but that you have to have the right name of the city and spelled correctly in the right case for the automation to work. You know, I'm an old IT, retired IT person. I couldn't write an algorithm that good, you know? So that's what we did. I started in mid August and I had 148,000 records to date. And that was 2001 to 2018. And I started with them and we added 2019, 2020 when it became available. That's adding county, lat long, latitude and longitude, zip code, and correcting the municipal and the county. Took 650 hours to do. Wow. I'm a former government contractor. Everybody logs their hours, you know.
You'll make a million once you sell your book, don't worry.
We hope so. We hope so. Wow. Well, we're doing something interesting with this book.
Okay.
The book that's coming out is the UFO Sightings Desk Reference 2001 to 2020. It's a 20-year sample of the first 20 years of the 21st century. That's coolness.
Did your data go back before that, or are you just taking this sample?
Only 2001 to 2020. We stayed with the 21st century.
But have you got data goes farther back? I mean, you had a sighting at 12, so you go back a long time, though.
Yeah, but I don't really have data.
Okay.
We could have pulled some of that data, but we put a thing in this book. We counted the high numbers, not the locations as much. We counted the high numbers. So if you look at the 19th, because people kept asking me when the book came out, why didn't you go back 40 years, Cheryl and Linda?
You got that better to do.
Well, yeah. So this time around, I reached, that data was available on Newfork. Yeah. I went to, when I got MUFON's data for 2019, 2020, I said, hey, would you do me dates only? Is all I was interested in. Dates only from 1960 to 2000 through 2000.
Okay.
They did. Neither database was compatible. It was like this. Okay. Neither one was compatible. And it took many hours to rearrange the data so it was compatible. There was about 4,000 sightings between both of them that were no good. The dates were no good.
Yeah.
But it added only about 13,000 reports over 40 years.
Okay.
Now, that doesn't sound like much. Okay. Because we're averaging 167,000 in the last 20 years. The deal is there's as you start coming, all the stuff, if you can see it on the camera, all the stuff from 1960 to 2000 was about what you see with my hand right there. That's how big it was.
Okay.
And then when you got to 2001, it started going up. It's because broadband began proliferating in major metropolitan and suburban areas. Broadband is a major, is one of the major drivers to UFO sightings. People always say, oh, it's about population. It's actually about a dozen things. I can read them off to you here in a little bit, but the bottom line was we went back that far. It only added about 13,000, but we weren't going to count it because we were only studying the 21st century.
Can I ask you right now, like if you're talking broadband, and I remember that coming in, that people don't realize back in the old days when I started, I mean, it was, everything was paper. You send a letter, wait for 2 weeks for the letter to come back. People have no clue. So like where today are the places where, because you know, Stan always used to do the thing about how many people have seen a UFO and all these hands go up, how many reported it, and like all the hands go down. So where do people now report UFO data on the internet?
Okay. Let me go back a little bit. It all started in 1952 with Coral Lorenz, with the lady who founded APRO. Okay. And she was collecting stuff. People were mailing clippings to her from all around the country. She actually started like in the late 47 with the big wave of 47 sightings. Yeah. And then by 52, she started this APRO group and reaching out. They peaked at about 1,500, almost 2,000 members at one point.
Yeah.
Okay. So some of that group, Illinois, broke off and later became MUFON. The Illinois chapter broke off. Okay, but in those days, prior to the internet, prior to about the mid-80s, people, if you were lucky to see a fluff piece on the local news, it said, hey, there's this guy out in Ohio, collects UFO data. You know, he's got an answering machine. He'll take your fax. He'll take your mail, whatever. We used to see stuff like that back in the 60s and 70s. And that's how it got sent in. Faxes. Newspaper clippings, or you call up somebody's answering machine and tell them what happened to you, you know, that type of thing. And that's how it was done. In the mid 80s, with the advent of things like CompuServe and America Online, we start seeing a little bit of a track upwards. Okay. And then by the late 90s, we're just starting to see a little bit of broadband. And by 2000, broadband is proliferating rather seriously. And I was in the IT industry, I had those charts, I knew exactly what was going on. And one of the biggest things that holds us back from the rural states is the lack of rural broadband that we're hearing about in the political circles right now. We need a Tennessee Valley Authority style effort to get rural broadband. And that's going to change the landscape of UFO sighting reports as that happens.
Yeah. Okay. And what about, because I'm just north of North Dakota in Canada. And I think MUFON in North Dakota is basically folded. Do you have that kind of problem where like major states like in North Dakota where there's basically
nothing,
no researchers or anything like that? Because people used to ask me about the numbers here in Manitoba. And I said, well, it depends how many researchers you've got. If you've got one researcher, you're going to have like 100 cases. If you've got five researchers, you're probably going to have 500 cases because you've got five times as many people gathering the data. So is there areas where you have like a vacancy of people even to report stuff?
Yeah. Well, no, it's not so much that, not anymore with the internet, but
okay.
Stuff still gets sent in manually, I hear. Yep. Okay. But you were talking Dakotas here. South Dakota and North Dakota are ranked number 49 and number 50 of states.
Okay.
Okay. In 20 years, they South Dakota had 418. North Dakota had 335. That's not much over 20 years. It's see, I even have an averages chart here. North Dakota averaged about 16 a year, about one a month and 0.3 a week kind of thing. You know, it's small. Where everything they've had in 20 years, California does in a week.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Related to that, let me ask you another question related to the North Dakota thing. Because when I started, they put the only anti-ballistic missile unit in the United States, 100 nuclear missiles in North Dakota. That's when it also went crazy. And you've done some work on nuclear missile sightings. Do you have a lot of stuff that, say, Robert Hastings hasn't picked up? Or is that really true where there's a lot of nuclear missile sightings in your data?
That's the problem. I went out and looked. Okay. Back when people did that in the 70s or like with New Fork data, a couple of one lady did that very extensively, and she mapped a lot of sightings around military bases.
Okay.
Since the fall of the Cold War in the late 80s, early 90s, a lot of those bases got throttled back to to National Guard or reserve bases.
Okay.
And only major bases that kept all the advanced technology really were getting any sightings. And I got confirmation on this from Lou Alessandro. I interviewed him 3 times.
Oh, is that right?
When I was doing the full-time journalism work.
Yeah, wow.
And he said, wherever our advanced technology is, he said, particularly with the fleets, they're very interested in our nuclear technology.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that, and when you look back historically, we were these primitives that were fighting it out with bombs and bullets back in World War II. And at about the end of that thing, we lit up a new kind of box of matches. And I think that scared a snot out of, oh my God, the primitives have this thing, you know, and the nuclear weapons. And it was right after that, we started getting all the traffic.
And
so there's a big thing there. But do I have any information showing around a military bases? Yeah, if I look at Norfolk, the Oceania area, that type of thing, there's a lot of sightings there. But I can, you know, I don't know if they're related to the military. Senator Rubio's office says they're related to the military, but I don't know if they are. Regarding the 55 nuclear power plants in the country, I have their street addresses. A couple of activist groups have great web pages. I have their municipal address. I have their county address, and nothing remarkable there.
Yeah.
Well, okay, except for maybe Indian Point, but that's they've had a lot of issues with UFOs for years, and they've had a leaky site for years too. So,
let's go to Alessandro and to the government. What about the government action? Like you're filing. You know, people say the government's got these big databases and they're tracking all this stuff. Is that true or not true? Or are they just watching military? Like Elizondo would seem to hint that they're just tracking the military stuff that they're really.
I asked him that because I said, look, I'm former military. I worked in very highly classified stuff.
Yeah.
And I said, I understand compartmentalization. You know, left hand typically doesn't know what the right hand's doing because of that. Okay. But I said, do you guys ever look at the MUFON or New Fork database? He said, we're not allowed to under Title 10, posse comitatus. Right. Okay. Okay, fine. So he was remarkably interested in my book. I sent him a copy. Okay. Yeah. The first one. But he told me, he said, their databases pretty much are tracking what's going on around military installations and the fleets. Yeah. Particularly. Okay. So he told me, I says, is a regular baseline of stuff. He says, no, he says, there's sometimes it just gets dry, nothing for weeks or months. And then suddenly the boards light up, you know, we got all kinds of stuff, you know, it's sporadic. And I said, okay, that was all I really wanted to know. Now, one other thing I did ask him, I says, I know you had deep compartmentalization authorization. He said, yes. I said, did you get to pick open some of the, all those pieces? And you know, he's always got that stoic face, you know. And I said, was it when you got into him, was it worth the reading? And he lit up like a kid on Christmas morning. And he says, yeah, it was, you know. I said, were you able to get at everything? He says, no, because it was so badly cataloged. Because remember, a lot of people didn't want to be associated with it over the years, that type of thing. I mean, it's half the problem now. We only got the intelligence community interested because the fleet's being buzzed beyond belief right in the last 10 to 12 years.
Yeah, okay? It's really not in anybody's sort of bailiwick. I mean, there's not
they
really
didn't want it.
Yeah.
They didn't want to get painted with the stigma most people don't want to get painted with.
Yeah.
That was the problem. But he did say that he said there were some we couldn't find because of the way they classifications that makes it sound like secret, top secret, type of thing. The way they cataloged it, okay, and classified the data in the context of its subject matter. He says there's still stuff they have not found, but he says a lot of it's available. They've read it. They there's a lot of interesting stuff's going on, but he couldn't go into it, and I wasn't going to press him on it because I understand the sensitivity.
Now you work for Lockheed. Do you ever get tired of the story of them asking you about the crash flying saucers at Skunk Works? because you know everybody figures like if you're in the government, you know everything. If you're at Lockheed, you would know everything. And you're, I mean,
I was a internal security investigator. I investigated IT security problems. I was an antivirus guru, and I was a what they call a red hat. I break into our own systems to find out where the bad guys can get in. Okay. And at one point I got to sit down after a 2-year study. I took my bosses aside, I said, I need a 2-hour meeting with you. And I showed them where all the bodies were buried and where all the holes were. And one woman stood up, one of the women managers said, I'm going to have to go to the mall today to get my hair colored. Scared the hell out of them. And from that side of the business, Skunk Works thing, I know nothing about them. I've heard the same stories everybody else hears. I know nothing about them, really.
Yeah, no, I'm saying, but you must have got tired of people asking you about it because once they hear where you work, or you're like in the Air Force or the Navy, and it's like, because I know I always said, like, I was a manager at the University of Manitoba, and I said, you know, if I knew everything, I had the keys to the president's office, the 8 vice president's offices, payroll, I had keys to everything you could possibly think of. And do you think I would have left 6 months before a buyout if I had known what was going on? It's like people make that assumption. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. The goofy thing was, I think I tell people, ask me, because I'm an Air Force and a Navy veteran.
Yeah.
Okay. Air Force wasn't that interesting. In fact, that's one of the really cool sightings I ever had was when I was in Vietnam, you know?
Tell me about that. I didn't know. Tell me about your first sighting and then tell me about Vietnam.
First sighting was about 12 years old, late August. It was a couple of weeks before school started back up. Okay. It had been a really great growing season. The corn was higher than our car, you know, that kind of thing. And we were up visiting an uncle at their farm. And we were starting to come down the dirt road from the uncle's farm. And again, like I said, corn on either side of us. And my mother has my father pull the car off the road a little bit, dirt road. And what's going on? Mom points out to a clear blue sky. It's about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, clear blue sky. There is, and you have to put your finger out, put your arm out and look at your little fingernail. That's how big this thing was. It was a sphere parked out there like a rock, shiny. And she said, well, NASA was only about 5-6 years old at that point, you know, it was 65. So she said, it might be something NASA's doing, might be something the Air Force doing, might be a weather balloon, might be people from another world. And that fascinated the 12-year-old. We're going, oh, wow, really? You know, so we talked about it a little bit more. We got back on the road, got down the hill, turned left to get on the state road and go home. That big old Chevy Impala, I crawled up in that back window. And because my brother and sister were toddlers, so they were like not conscious of this. But I'm looking up at those guys saying, who are you guys? Who are you guys? When that thing decided to go, I didn't see another effect like it until like the last 20 years with some of these starship movies. It was that gone thing, you know, and go, it changes you. Okay. It changes you. At that point, you know, teenagers are, you know, mom and dad are stupid, you know, that kind of thing. You know, mom and I actually had a pretty good relationship on this context because we had something in common. So we'd go to the books. We were reading books by Frank Edwards, you know, all the guys that wrote them back in those days, you know, and I'd read one, she'd read one, and we'd do it like a book report for each other on Friday evening or something like that when my dad was working. And then, got in the late 60s, we got a copy of Von Daniken's Chariots of the Gods. She dog-eared on the top of the page. I dog-eared on the bottom. That book was destroyed, you know. But the deal is, in fact, by the way, our first UFO sightings desk reference, Eric has one. Eric Von Daniken has a signed copy, you know, and he thought it was fantastic. So, here we are 6 years later. I'm in Cameron Bay, Vietnam. I'm an Air Force telephone line person, climb telephone poles for a living. People shoot at you on those things, you know? a lot, believe me. And it was Christmas Eve, about 11:30. A friend of mine from my barracks and I were walking down to the base chapel to go to midnight mass for something to do.
Okay.
I wasn't really a practicing Catholic at that point.
Okay.
And that became because I had a blossoming of mystical stuff when I was in high school. So I wasn't a practicing Catholic, but we went down to go to midnight mass. So we're walking down midnight mass and up over Taurus, constellation Taurus in western sky, gazillion stars, one of those kinds of nights. And we see the streak growing across the sky. Jet, you know, it's Vietnam, you know,
it's Vietnam.
You know, and then it stops. And Tom looks at me and says, they don't stop. Helicopters stop, but jets don't stop. And helicopters don't fly that fast. And I said, yeah, I know. I said, Tom, if that's what I think it is, it's going to start dancing around like a fairy in a couple of minutes. And darn, gone, you know. Neither one of us had our mind in midnight mass when we got
That goes to the question about, like, when I saw mine 1975, just in fact, as the Vietnam War was ended, it was two weeks after the Vietnam War when I had my first two sightings. And so let me ask you about the question. Do you buy into this idea that it may not be random? That, you know, it like I always ask people, when you see the UFO, what's it doing? Nothing. It's like, or the thing, why would a UFO jump around in the sky? Like, you know, it's like, sort of like it's sort of playing. It's one, look at this. Do you buy into this thing that it may actually be a tie in to you, that they are sort of trying to trigger you? Because you see people, you can tell somebody who's had a sighting and you say, they'll know exactly what the weather was, what time of the day it was, 1969. And they know every little detail as if it, once they saw it and you say, well, it's just a light in the sky, but it triggers you as if it's like a personal event.
It's a personal event. And this is the mystic talking, okay, lifelong mystic. It changes you in a way, in a spiritual way, as well as an intellectual way.
Yeah.
Okay. And I know two other researchers who've come to a similar conclusion. One of them uses my data religiously. Okay. Wow. Okay. Let's look at it from that standpoint. I did at least two stories in my columns. I wrote my newspaper, weekly newspaper column from UFO oriented for your audience. Okay. From July of 2013 through June of 2019, when the paper went under, like a lot of newspapers are. And it was the hottest, amazingly enough, they tried me out for a month and they said, well, we'll most likely not have you after a month. And they got me in there a month later. And he says, you're pulling more page views than all the columnists combined. Keep doing it. Okay. I told him it'd be a hot topic, you know.
Did you have any discussions with Billy Cox? Because I remember talking to Billy. I'd known Billy for 30 years. And he always used to say, well, he had huge numbers as well. But he said, still, my editor just tolerated what I did. They still didn't have any interest, even though he was getting the numbers.
My editor was sympathetic. He had read, apparently, over coffee, he told me, before he hired me, he told me we had read the same books. Yeah. So he's about my age. So we had a similar background and he had had a sighting in high school as well. Okay. So he was sympathetic. The digital editors, I had a series of digital editors since I was a web columnist. Okay. I did a blog column and they, most of them came in skeptical and they all left the paper believers. Okay, from reading, from editing my columns. Now, there were two columns that I wrote where there were multiple people, let's say like 8 to 10 people together out camping someplace in the Adirondacks or something. And this thing comes down and makes, it's not just a little point of light in the sky. It's down here. It's big. It's bold. Three or four of them can describe it to a T. Two of them vaguely saw it. And at least two people said, what? I don't see anything. See, that's what led me to believe that there's some people are intended to see this thing.
Yeah.
Okay. There is a mystical quality to this and it does change you. And again, you can get me on another whole conversation about consciousness being the way we really need to be addressing this. And the soft, and you know, for 70 years, the hardware people and the hard sciences have been trying to drive this investigation, at least in the civilian context, right? And we really need to get the soft sciences involved.
Yeah.
because there's another whole aspect. There's the sociological and anthropological aspects that should be studied because of all the experiencers we've got and just the people who are just interested in it,
yeah.
You know, because touching us makes you interested and that's something, it gets a different mindset going.
Yeah.
There's all this that needs to be looked at. I wrote last year, a friend of mine who's a therapist, and I wrote a letter to the New York State Society of Social Workers, counselors. And we explained what the situation was with the stuff, with the amount of people that see them and are experiencers. And I offered to come give a presentation like I do at conferences, you know, silence. Wrote a second letter a couple of months after that, you know, again, crickets.
Yeah.
So finally I call them up on the phone, got one person really pumped and interested. She told me, let me do a couple of things and check and let's talk again later in the week. It's fine. I call her back later in the week. Nobody wants to talk about it. But here we got an area that we got people who desperately need counseling because they saw something bigger than life and can't tell anybody about it. It's damaged her marriage because she's holding a secret or he's holding a secret. You know, I've run into situations where people have told me, you know, my wife thinks I've got an affair going because I won't tell her about my UFO sighting.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing.
I had the experience in 2012 where I moved from nuts and bolts to consciousness. I remember Jerry Pippin. You may have remembered Jerry Pippin.
Heard the name.
Yeah, he's a big interviewer at the time. And I was doing the presidential stuff, which everybody thought was pretty cool. You know, you're doing the presidency. And then he said, well, I can't believe you've done that. I can't believe you've gone from presidential stuff to consciousness. I mean, I can't believe you did it. I said, well, I kind of got teleported, Jimmy. I didn't really go there, Jerry. And so talk about it a little bit, because that is a very big interest to me. And I think where this thing will probably end up going is this idea that it has this mystical aspect to it. It's 1,000 times more complex than people think it is. And we're starting to move there, because in 2012, even myself, I couldn't have spelled consciousness and I couldn't have cared less. And now, I mean, I don't really do presidents anymore. I don't really do anything. I just realized that this is a significant thing. So can you talk about yours? And do you think Elizondo understands that in terms of all that he's experienced? Does he understand this aspect, or are they still into the thing about, you know, the threat and we need the technology and
metamaterials and all that?
Yeah. Yeah. Which I sort of asked the metamaterials. I don't know if you studied the cases, but I said to them, do you actually believe that a flying saucer came across the galaxy and then a little piece started falling off it? And to me, it's like they're dropping this stuff. I mean, they've got to be dropping it. It's like to go, wow, like what's going on here?
It's technical seating for the natives. Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
There was a movie many years ago in the 70s or 80s there about the gods must be crazy because somebody threw a Coke bottle out and it fell into the village.
Yeah.
You know, and that was a great metaphor for this, believe me. The consciousness stuff, I very rarely can get into a decent conversation with anybody. Now, I was at the Arkansas conference last in 2019.
Okay.
Ray Hernandez from the Gordon
the Edgar Mitchell Foundation.
The Mitchell Edgar Mitchell Foundation.
Yeah.
Was there. And Ray and I during meetings, that conference encourages you to mix with the clientele.
Yeah.
And the hotels serve these really good pieces of pie. And so him and I sat down at a round table out in this chat area and started getting into a conversation. Next thing you know, people are quietly pulling chairs up around us because we're having this very spirited debate going, right? You know, and in the course of the conversation, we're talking deeply about the spiritual connection and the fact that all this paranormal stuff, you know, Bigfoot and ghosts and portals and time travel shouldn't be all stovepiped in these stovepipes like academia would have it. It's all one thing.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, and we had this great conversation going. At one point, I've got my hand up like this, sitting on a cantaloupe. Okay. I've got my hand up like that. And I'm sitting there talking. And I says, you know, it's hard to explain, but you've got to be connected to the ship. It talks to you. It sings to you while you're connected to it and does anything you want. And the two guys next to me, oh my God, I had my hand on that silver ball too.
Is that right? Wow. Yeah.
But the thing is, if you ask them about it, they didn't know about it. But as soon as we started relating an experience, suddenly they're there with you.
Yeah.
And they were spilling, but they didn't realize they were.
Yeah.
It was amazing to listen to it. I wish I had had a recorder to get it. I didn't have my little newspaper reporter thing, you know. But yeah,
that's interesting. I remember because Ray Hernandez had his experience the day I was watching Colin Andrews give a lecture. That's when I got this sort of download thing that it's all consciousness. This is what the answer to this thing is. And Ray Hernandez, a week later, had his experience with the dog. That's how it started. A week later. And then when I went to, he brought in the one craft where he's sort of said, I want to see what my wife is looking at. And then the Wembley Stadium shows up over the next door neighbor's house. And then he goes, there's some connection here. So he puts consciousness, UFOs. And of course, my name pops up. He contacts me. He says, something's going on. You can actually, there's some connection here. And I said, well, I'm coming to Florida and I'm giving a lecture on consciousness. Why don't you come down and then we can talk. So he comes, that's 2 days later after that, he met me. That's when he had the experience on the freeway where they take him out and they say, you got to quit parsing this stuff. It's all the same thing. And then he just sort of goes off the deep end, you know, and it's sort of like,
he told me about that deep end experience.
Yeah. And that's when you see, when you start getting into that kind of stuff, then, and a guy with his amount of knowledge, I mean, an IRS guy that sort of went, you know, just totally lost it and has read everything.
He's an attorney.
Got obsessed. Yeah. Those are the kind of conversations that I don't think people really even realize. Even when I asked Bray, because I've got 50 people who've flown the craft. I my first one in 2013, I was ready to throw the woman out of the house. I thought she was insane. And that was the whole thing about putting your hand on the panel or the ball and you become one with the craft and the craft is alive and whatever you think. And I remember talking to Ray and I said, Ray, there's like in your survey shows that 13% of people have flown the craft. And he said, well, people describe all sorts of stuff. And I said, well, yeah, they can describe, you know, a round room and stuff. But when they start talking about flying the craft, don't think we should talk to them. And when you see the consciousness, then you realize that, how do you walk that back? There's no way you can walk that back when someone says, I put my hand on a panel and suddenly I had a 747 United Airlines pilot. I had a retired U.S. Air Force colonel. And they were all telling me these same stories. And they said, oh, it's I think it was a dream. I said, everybody thinks it's a dream. Just tell me your story. And it's like they're reading off a cue card. Okay. First thing they tell me, go put your hand on the panel. I don't know what I'm doing. And the whole thing, it's just fascinating. So I'm glad that you're following this line of, because that's, I think, where we got to go.
One of the goofy things with me with that one was, I'm going to say it the way it comes out. Okay.
Yeah.
Making a very tight maneuver, and in my head I'm thinking, but the G forces are going to be too bad. I shouldn't be doing this. And the other voice says, I'm compensating for it. you know. Okay.
When did that experience happen? You had that experience?
Yeah.
So when was that? Was that later on? That must have been much later on.
Okay, I lived in a Buddhist monastery from.
That's right, you did.
From 1997 through around 2007.
Wow.
Okay, it's not like you think you're living in this big Gothic place, you know. Yeah. It's I was ordained Buddhist nun. I hold yogi vows now. So I'm allowed to be, if I wear robes, it's these white and burgundy ones, you know, but, I'm allowed to be married, but my spouse had to be equally qualified.
Wow.
So my spouse is the closest thing you're going to get to a Zen master. My lama had to interview her.
Wow.
Okay. We had to be equally compatible. So it's weird, but, during the course of working in the monastery, I still had my day job at Lockheed, and I went to work at Lockheed headquarters every day, dressed like the Dalai Lama, the buzz cut, the robes, the whole thing, you know. And there were two of us, and we both worked for corporate security. We're both part of the same group. And there were only 105 people in corporate security, the high level corporate security. Statistically, Buddhist nuns were taking over security at Lockheed. You know, it was goofy. But my lama had me working with, he picked me out of a crowd of 150 people. That's a big deal with the Tibetans.
Wow.
Okay. And said, I know you. And we had some very deep talks. and he knew me better than my mother. And he didn't say Cheryl, me who's behind this mask of flesh. Okay.
Yeah.
And he had me doing a lot of deep meditation work in the idea of deep contemplation to the great consciousness. Okay. Give you an example. There was a 16-week, it's like a master's program in Buddhism.
Okay.
It's like 12 hours a day. I couldn't go. I had a day job and I didn't have enough vacation to go to something like that. Okay. So I went to him and said, Lamala, I can't do that. He says, oh, no, no, no. He says, you previous incarnation, I know you've been through this. He says, tell you what, I want you to, in your meditation, contemplate the subject matter. Okay. I said, okay, fine. So I did this in the course of the next 16 weeks worth of my meditation. So, and I meditate 2 or 3 times a day. And it's not for many hours, like a lot of people think, you know, now 10 or 15, once you get into the swing of it, 10 to 15 minutes in the morning, 10 to 15 minutes, maybe at lunchtime, and maybe a half an hour after supper or before bed, you're wired into everything. Okay. So we're going along and I come in, I get a call from his aide and he says, would you please come down? And it was towards the end of their 16 week thing. So I go in there. He waves me in, sit down. So I'm sitting in there with all these other monks and nuns and things. And please understand, they thought I was the flakiest novice in the place.
Okay.
Didn't give me, most of the seasoned monks wouldn't give me the time of day. Okay. And we're sitting in there. So he'd ask 5 or 6 questions from the last 16 weeks worth of stuff, you know, and then other people were raising the question. Then about every 6th question, he'd ask something really, really hard. And everybody just sat there and he said, okay, my Buddhist name is Tashi. So Ani means none. Ani Tashi. And I'd give him the answer. After I did this 5 times, 2 senior monks stand up and says, this is the goofiest, flunkiest novice we got in the place. How come she's answering questions we can't answer? And his 2 answers are mind boggling. First answer was, he says, what did you do? And I said, well, you told me to contemplate everything and it just sort of downloaded. And everybody's like, give me this dirty look. You know, I mean, I've been here 12 hours a day, 16 weeks, and you just downloaded it. You know, the other statement he made, he said, what else is it? I says, well, based on that last question, it's quantum physics.
Okay.
And Lamala gets a big cat ate the canary look on his face. He says, yes. And we had it 2,600 years ago. Wow. So somebody's been helping us with this stuff. The deal is with the consciousness. I've been teaching all my students to reach out and touch. Okay. All my remote viewing students have been to the base on the backside of the moon in the last 20 years. That card always makes itself into that cycle of a bag of 100 cards that we use for a remote viewing class. Right. And I've taught 5 or 6 remote viewing classes in the last 20 years. And every one of those classes, eventually that card bubbled to the top, and they put down their pens at the end of the session and said, usually somebody would say, some lady would say, boy, whoever those folks were, they weren't pleased with us being there. That kind of thing. They were aware of us. Okay. And so that's what really got me on the consciousness thing, that if we're going to touch them, we've got to reach out and touch the great consciousness and plug into everything. Now, you're not going to do it with 5 minutes worth of meditation every week. You know, you really got to start developing the skill. And once you develop the skill, and I know people come to me all the time, well, I've been doing it for 3 months and I haven't touched ET yet. And I said, slick, I was doing it for 6 years before I did, you know, trust me, you will eventually, just keep it up.
Yeah. It's almost like we're no different than any other social or political movement. People figure because it's important, we should get it right away. And it's like, no, you got to do the work. I mean, just like any other discipline that what do you see in terms of ufology? Are we starting to catch on? Are we starting to get that aspect? And I went back to Elizondo. Do you think Elizondo understands this, knowing all the inside stuff? Because I don't know if you followed like Kit Green, where they're following the experiencers around, you know, with the DNA and the Kadat Putain and all the stuff in the brain, and they realize that the experiencer, these people have some sort of contact, and maybe we should check out what they're doing, that they seem to understand that it's much, you know, or even where Kit Green says that your religious take on it or your personal view will determine in a large way what you're seeing, and that two people standing beside each other won't necessarily see the same thing, which indicates, oh, they may know something here. This is kind of getting into the field where you're starting to realize this, we're the component of what we're seeing and stuff like that. So do you think Elizondo understands, or are they still really back in the nuts and bolts?
I have never been able to get, I've had three deep conversations with him, two of them at a MUFON conference over coffee and donuts, you know. He plays it really close. He's a former intelligence officer. He plays it close to his chest, you know, and I worked in that gig too. So I understand there's a tendency to hold it close. The thing about the perspective, well, let me give it to you perspective. Somebody asked me that question sometime back. He says, well, what's the difference perspective? I says, I think the easiest way to put it is, are you expecting to meet St. Peter when you pass, or Anubis, or, you know, and I listed all three or four more guys, you know, and I said, I mean, Anubis is big in my household, you know, so, you know, and then the guy looked at that, these people I was talking to, and said, oh, it is a perspective, how it's caged. And I said, it's a filter for how our brain sees it, or how our intellect sees it. But the concepts are at a high, very high level, and we have to interpret it. And that's the problem, is everything we're sensing is beyond concept. This is the Buddhist training. It's beyond concepts are what we do. What it is just essence.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned portals. Give me your take on the portal thing.
Let me give you one real quick one. There was a kid in high school, my grade. He moved away a long time ago. I heard about 15, 20 years ago, he was killed in a car wreck. Okay. Yeah. But when we were in high school, he was one of the kids in school that was, very psychic. Okay. Now, I came from a clairvoyant family. I had an appreciation for where he was coming from, but he was light years beyond anything I was. Okay. Or my brother was, and it's about 65, 66 time frame. There was a wave of UFOs about that time, and particularly in New York State. And he said, I think I can call him. And we were all, it was just before the streetlights were coming on. We were all laughing on somebody's front porch. Oh, yeah, right. You know, he says, watch. And he kind of goes down this little stoic little thing there for a minute. And we're all kind of snickering a little bit. And he says, there, I reached out and touched him. And we all, you know, the lights were on. We all had to go home. Okay, fine. The streetlights come on, you go home, right? So the next morning, we were sitting on the porch of the guy was my future shop teacher in school. Okay, we were sitting on his porch. He lived across the street from me. Next morning, I saw him out on his porch, and he waved me over, and I came over and says, what's up? Did you see the paper today? No. What's in it? Look here. UFO, 345 reports of a UFO flying at treetop height within a block of where we were. So I just heard static. Can you hear me?
No, I can hear you. You're coming.
Okay, good. I can hear you too. Okay. I just heard a blast of static.
No, you're coming through clear.
Oh, yeah. Men in black. They're always doing things. I do radio interviews on a telephone, and a thing will always cut out. Okay. And two or three reporters says, does that happen to you often? I said, welcome to my world.
So So let's go men in black. Do you think that's government, or do you think that's the intelligence?
All of the above.
Okay.
I don't think the government's that organized, but the intel groups are, you know, a lot better. Okay. Your question about portals. Let me give you a flavor on this. You're going to love this because you've heard this no place else but me.
Okay.
The database that we had from 2001 to 2015,
okay,
I only shared one copy of it, and it was with a retired astronomy physics professor at Sonoma University. Okay. Because he was the one that actually got me interested in doing the data. He asked me a strange question at down in Tempe, Arizona, one of the conferences down there, and UFO Congress. And I didn't have an answer for him. I said, I'd have to look into it. And that's what got me looking at the idea of putting county data with the UFO data. Okay. But the deal was, I asked him this question. I gave him the database. I said, you know, I've calculated everything I can. I've got a few more ideas of things I want to do. But I said, I don't have the skills to see if sightings have any kind of linkage to sidereal time, which is star time. Okay. For your audience, the star that's overhead right now, right this minute, tomorrow at this time will be overhead about 3.5 to 4 minutes sooner. And the day after that, 2 to 3, 4 more minutes sooner. After about a week, next week, it will be overhead about 30 minutes sooner. Okay. It's a 23 hour, 56 minute day. Don't say 24 hours. It's 23 hours, 56 minutes. Okay. All right. It's very precise. And okay. So sidereal time. So I said, maybe this is a sidereal time factor. And we talked about it on the phone and, you know, we both came up, it'll probably be white noise. It'll probably just be flat, random white noise. So he ran some checks that were kind of synchronized with me, looking at when most sightings are during normal civil time. It's about 68 to 70% are between 5 o'clock at night and about 11:30 at night. Okay. The other 16 hours a day, it's only about 25, 30% of the sightings. Okay. So we both had similar numbers there. He ran these calculations on several states because he had to put latitude and longitude with them, things like this. And, you know, I said how consuming that is. He came back and he said, they're all coming up around 18 to 18:30, that was six o'clock sidereal time to 6:30 sidereal time. Well, that's when the galaxy is directly overhead. Now, some people in the audience may say, well, duh, there's a gazillion stars when the galaxy's overhead. But 6 months out of the year, it's overhead during the daytime. Okay. But most of the sightings were peaking during that window of time. Linda and I sat down and talked about this over a friendly glass of wine and she suggested, well, maybe there's a portal. You know, I mean, the center of the galaxy is directly out there. So maybe there's a portal and they just keep popping out of that, you know? And that's why more people see them at this particular time. And that's the only conclusion we've ever had for portals.
Okay. Isn't there something with remote viewing about stars, about the, if you're in a certain direction?
Yes. Okay. That's the 1330 effect.
Okay.
That's 1:30 sidereal time. Okay. Remember, this is a moving target through the year. Okay. I've done a couple of studies. If you're within a 2 hour window of it, within 30 minutes of it, either way, that would be 1 o'clock sidereal time to 2 o'clock sidereal time and 1330 being right in the middle of it. There's a 450% increase in the psychic ability. If you're within the 2 hour window, an hour, either way of that peak time, it's about a 250% increase in yield. Okay. And I've taught it to all my students. I've taught a quick, easy way and said, I don't have to get computers or anything. I showed them a real easy way to do it on a graph. And I did a study. In fact, I wrote an article for Wicca Magazine that all of the major pagan holidays peak on the sidereal, this particular sidereal time, but at different times. Now, I don't know if you know any Catholics. They used to practice a thing called the Angelus. 6 o'clock in the morning, the bells would ring and they'd say prayers, noon and 6 o'clock at night. So these 6 hour windows. Okay. And we don't know where the Catholics got that. They probably stole it from the pagans, like many other things. But the deal is I ran the calculations on the four major holidays, and it's 6 o'clock in the morning, it's noon, it's 6 o'clock at night, and it's midnight is when that sidereal time is. So if somebody knew this on these holidays, and if you did this even within a month of that window of time, you're still in that window because it only moves a couple of minutes a day. So it's like somebody, if you say these prayers every day at this time, sooner or later, you're going to be at this high peak point, you know, that kind of thing. And I found it very suspicious. So I wrote a rather detailed article. I'll send you a link to it. A really deep article for Wicca Magazine. And they loved it. And they ended up hiring me as a regular columnist for them.
All your articles, I heard you recovered all your articles that you'd written. Do you plan to publish that in books? Or?
Oh, it is published already. I did it during 2020. Had nothing better to do. And, you know, I put on 20 pounds. I have managed to lose it all. This morning, I logged my weight.
There you
go. I'm now what I was a year ago before we went into this massive eating and depression cycle.
Is there a secret to that?
Yeah, I fast 18 hours a day.
There you go.
No, really. But people say, well, I couldn't do that. No, you sleep through most of it. I eat supper. I don't eat again till noon. Yeah. I skip breakfast. Okay. So I just eat lunch and supper. And then about 2 days a week, randomly, I don't even eat at noon. So I give myself a 24-hour day fast, and that helps burn off more stuff. Plus, I've been writing this book, and that burns glucose, which burns fat material as I'm fasting. So I've been burning this thing off rather nicely. My diabetic nurse is doing cartwheels, you know.
There you go. So let me ask you another consciousness question. I wrote a book called Inspired, the Paranormal World of Creativity. Whatever you're looking at, whether it's remote viewing or people get stuff in dreams, have you had any of this kind of stuff? And is it make sense that there is the answers out there and it's the ability to tap into that? Like people near death experience or UFO experiencers will say, at one point during my experience, I knew the answer to everything in the universe. And you go like, well, you're going to make up a story. That's not a story you're going to try to make up.
Let's say it this way. I think a vast majority of what people think are in, picked up in a flying saucer, that type of thing.
Yeah.
I think maybe you've had one of those experiences, but I think that the ongoing experiences are done on a psychic level. And the only time you can get down into the deep states you need to be is when you're in deep phase sleep. In our household, we refer to it as, oh, the Lords of Zog were visiting last night. Yeah. And that's the event that you're subjected to, it almost seems like, let's see what she'll do if we give her this situation, you know, and it's manifested. It's not, think of it like a mental holodeck or something in that order. And they're constantly learning from us. And in a sense, we're certainly learning from them. If you allow yourself to be open to what they're subjecting you to, it's not nightmarish, but it can get really strange.
Yeah. Well, so do we go to the point where this is this big debate about the abduction where Kit Green says no abductions, Edgar Mitchell says no abductions, Valet says crazy. I mean, is this a mental thing or how much of it is physical and how much of it is like these people that had the flew the ship, they always said, it was a dream. And I say, everybody says it's a dream, but everybody tells the same story. And it's so how much of the UFO phenomenon, well, I guess everything. I mean, if you're into Eastern religions or Buddhism, I mean, it's all going to be consciousness, correct?
Yes.
Do I have it right? They can come in, they can manifest in the physical and go back into wherever they're coming from.
Okay. I think there's several degrees of it. There's the hardware aspect.
Okay.
You know, the thing landed out in the farm field, came in and carried a Whitley Strieber out to it.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. There's those kinds of things. I've talked to people and I've met experiencers. I've met over 100 now as a journalist. And I've seen people with the scoops and things like this. We've been tracking somebody who at least once a week wakes up with these iridescent marks on them. Okay. And you can only find them in a black light, you know, and the person never knew that they happened. It was always joking about maybe these things come at night, you know, and I had gone to a lecture at IUFOC and the guy said, you know, yeah, put a black light on them, you know, and I did. And oh my God, you know, but there's the physical side of this thing. Are they landing a ship? Or are they just opening up a portal between wherever they are to my bedroom or to Joe's bedroom or Susie's bedroom? You know, there's that. And then there's the aspect of connecting to us at a consciousness level. Now, the consciousness level, I am there with you. Living in a Buddhist monastery, I used to sit there to help me get into deep states after my controlled meditation. I used to put the Monroe Institute stuff in my ears before I went to bed. And boy, I went some way out places. Okay. And the thing is it wasn't a trip. There was no drugs involved. I got myself into a deep theta state and suddenly the universe was open to me. And I tried to explain it to new students. I said, don't think it like astral projection. You leave your body. My Lama and I will tell you, if you leave your body, you die. But that doesn't mean you can't be like a television set. You're just changing your channels to different parts of the consciousness of the universe. Okay. And you're just shifting your consciousness there, not leaving your body. And that's how the mechanism really works. If you're talking metaphysically, you leave your body, you die, but you can almost shift your consciousness.
Even sometimes people hear the quote, John Wheeler, there is no out there, out there. This idea that if you're having an out of body experience, you're going within, everything is within. There's only one thing. There's one. You know, people have this idea about time and space, and then people say it doesn't exist, that, you know, in quantum physics, this may be an illusion. And they go, yeah, I know that. But then they keep talking about it. And this idea of this, where you're talking about this levels of vibration rather than here, there, and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, do you think the UFO community will catch on to this? Do you think, because right now, I think most people are still in the entertainment phase there. And I can ask you, what do you think of disclosure? What do you think is going to happen? And I remember I sort of got a message one point where I sort of got the message. They said, so when you get disclosure, what are you going to do? Are you all going back to church? That's like,
Linda and I had I was 69 last week. Okay. So she took me out for a birthday dinner at a high end place that does brilliant fish work, work with fish. And it's a high end restaurant. And while we were sitting there, and the waitress towards the end was wrapping up things with us and said, what do you guys do? And Linda works, she's a university librarian type thing. And I said, I'm a retired writer and I specialize in UFOs. She says, oh, I think they're going to come here and eat us. I said, no, they don't want to eat us. And well, they're going to come down here and just, blast us into the Stone Age. I said, they could have done that 500 years ago. She says, what do you mean? I said, April 14th, 1561, check it out on the internet. The bottom line is that there's a lot of polls have said about 30% are believers. Okay. Yeah. I hate that term, but I prefer the term knowers. Okay. And then there's about another 40% or so that are on the fence. Okay. And then 17%, junk, crazy, kooks, nuts, crackpots.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's 17%. Think about it. It's still about 54 million people that are going to be the ones that were sort of like during War of the Worlds in 1938. They're going to take their kids out in the backyard and prepare to shoot them in case the Martians are here. I mean, that's why 1947 in Roswell was cleaned up the way it was. They'd only had that happen 10 years before that half the country went nuts over a radio program. Okay. That's what people miss. That's why the secrecy was there. And so it's, I don't know. I don't know how people are going to react. They've been goosing us into it slowly, but in one of my articles I wrote in the 40s and 50s, all the aliens were bug-eyed monsters, slithery monsters. Okay. Yeah. Now they are our most revered fictional characters. Mr. Spock, Doctor Who, Chewbacca, whatever. Yeah. And so it's that kind of a situation that we've been conditioned for this, and it's probably not going to be that big a deal. The biggest people are going to have the hardest problem right now are the mainstream news people. They all drank their predecessors drank the Kool-Aid, and they're now the generation of people who were taught by the guys who drank the CIA Kool-Aid. Oh, this is kooks, nuts, and the Condon Report, oh, there's nothing to this, The academics are the same way. I tried to get a presentation up to five different colleges, and they laughed me off the phone.
Yeah.
Because
I came from a university as well, so I know what you're talking about in terms of that mentality. So tell me a little bit about your trying to get academia to even just listen to you. Forget about, start something.
Well, when Linda and I are done with this book and the 50 books that come with it.
Yeah.
And I said 50 books come with it. We're doing an individual book of statistics for every single state of the union.
Wow.
Five books about shapes and a couple about something called event windows. It's a forensic thing I developed with UFOs data. It's going to be about 50, 60 books.
Wow.
We literally want to go up to the state university in our state and lay out our 60 books and say, we'll take our PhDs now.
Good luck.
But I never expected to see low light footage on NBC News like there was two, three nights ago about with the pyramids.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, and people say, why now? People keep asking me why now. And I said, I think they just got sick of us ignoring it. Now there might be something bigger going on. They really feel the deep state feels there's a need to get it out in the open. As the secret's been held too long. There's that angle too, or maybe a little each. That's what I think.
Wow. Now you mentioned different shapes. So I had a book I did on triangles. I don't know if I'll release it or so. Give me a little insight on triangles.
Triangles. One of the heavy hitters. I stopped really paying a lot of attention to them because everybody kept telling me everybody's been throwing TR3B in my face. Yeah. Okay. We do a chapter in our book called The Truth is in the Exotic Shapes.
Okay.
And we've identified it down to like the squares, this, the ovals, the egg shapes, the rectangles. Okay. That type, the changing UFO. The changing UFO is the most regular and most stable UFO out there, but almost nobody knows it exists because if you plot all of the UFOs up on one chart, and then look for the changing UFO. It is so close to the baseline down here in the bottom of the graph, you can't even see it unless you actually do a report on that and blow it up. And you find out there's only about 70 to 120 sightings a year. But when that shape is one of the ones that's really special. The other one.
So tell me what the changing UFO is. What are you talking about?
Dr. Vallee was talking about them. You're out there with your equipment. You see the thing. And when you put your gear on it, it changes.
Okay. I had two of those. Okay. That's what I thought you were talking about. I've had two.
Okay. Now is that an incredibly intelligent AI ship that knows you're looking at it and then puts a different projection in your mind of what you think you're seeing, which is what I think it is.
Yeah.
Then there's the other one that's even better. And this is the one that got Lou Elizondo really stoic looking. 2017 MUFON convention in New Jersey, Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Linda and I had a little computer set up with a color printer and we could print it. You tell us what your county is and what state and county you're in. And we'll print you out a little thing of sightings, right? And I was talking to Lou over a cup of coffee on Saturday morning. I said, hey, you know, everybody's saying that UFOs are in the toilet and everything. You know, I said, there are three shapes that are not. In fact, they're on the increase. He says, what? And I printed it out for him. You remember in 1986, there was the JAL flight coming over from Japan at freighter, a 747 freighter. That thing was a half a mile wide. Okay. Whenever there's only about 40 sightings of them a year, but when they show up, the ovals and the eggs show up with them. So it's almost like the Saturn is the mothership and teardrop shape is like a shuttle ship and the egg shape is like a little scout ship and it has the respective, increases in volume of sightings like you would expect, you know, like if an aircraft carrier pulls up, you know, you got bigger helicopters supplying things and you got little scout helicopters, that kind of thing. That's what it looks like. And they all go up together. And just recently I plotted the changing shape and it's in the same profile.
Wow.
We think that's a stealth observation ship or something, but it's a little scary when you look at that and say, wow, this is something regularly scheduled. And it's so far here in the United States, we have this attitude of, oh, what's the mega biggest sighting you got? What's the thing that shows up the most, you know, the light in the sky, for God's sakes, you know, but I said, that's not the big deal. The biggest and brightest and all that is not where the secrets are. The secrets are in these tiny numbers. And this Saturn shape, changing shape, oval and teardrop shape they're all under 200 sightings a year. And they're the ones that are tracking together, but nobody would see them because they're so far down in the grass. The metaphor is we're walking through the tall wheat. These guys are the snake or the little mouse that's crawling across your shoe.
Yeah.
Not the tall grass.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so finally, can you tell me about your you just told me your book is being published. You've got a bunch of books. So when contact comes, what can people get now? What's the latest?
Amazon. Amazon. We publish through Amazon. So worldwide distribution. What's not the like, you know?
And so every state is like a separate book type thing.
Yes. Okay. Yes. They won't be out yet. We got to get this statistics book. This is the summary. This is that got all our heavy research in it that Linda and I did. And it's 2001 through 2020. And we've got some really cool tables in there. When we start putting the state books out, probably in a month or so, we're going to try and put 4 to 5 of them out a month because they're a smaller book, similar material, but we are going to give you a printout in the table that goes your state, all your counties, and all your right down to the cities for 20 years worth of sightings, 2001 through 2020. It's on a landscape. It's the only way we could print it. But every single state will have their sightings in it. Now, it's not stories. And I got to warn people, this is not field investigations. This is not great stories to read. It's just the data, the numbers of what happened. But you can look up your hometown, and if it's had a sighting in the last 20 years and it was reported, it's in there.
And you're self-publishing. And that's, I think, is almost like the internet, that once we get into self-publishing, then you control the game and you can put stuff out very, very fast and update it, change stuff as it moves along. I think it's a different world now with the...
It is. When you publish to like Amazon, once you put it up there, you're pretty much stuck with it. So you got to be really careful. We went through a great deal of editing and making double checking to make sure we didn't have any glitches. Like we had a couple of glitches in the last book, but we had to make sure it was exactly the way we wanted. And because we built in these PDFs, we could take them down to Staples and run off a sample copy. And we've got a notebook here. It's this thick, you know, for the book. It's over 400. It's about 430 pages is what we're going to press with. The state books will probably be in the 250 maybe range that day. They're going to be thinner, more for the consumer who wants to take it like a Guinness Book of Records. Wow, our hometown had this. Look what the county overhead, you know, that kind of thing.
You don't have to buy 500 copies to try to sell them and stuff like that. It's very individualized in terms of data that you can produce that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And there's a marketing thing to it, too, to be honest with you. There was a guy who gave us a seminar last year who writes children's books.
Yeah.
He says it's better to write 50 small children's books than one big book of children's stories, because then once you get it up on the sale thing, they're all at the end of the month. You're old enough to know what a phone bill looks like. A lot of little charges add up to a big phone bill.
Yeah.
These things, all these little sales add up to a big number at the end of the month if you get enough of them out there working for you. And by thinking globally and printing locally through the internet for all these 50 states, there'll be a lot of people who will say, hey, I want to see a book. And there's a book out there called, I'm going to tell you, UFOs in Nevada skies, UFOs in New York skies. They're all titled the same thing, UFOs in California skies. And that's how it'll be. We're just thinning it down, a little bit of science with it, pertinence about all the shapes, pertinence about how the United States fares up, and then specific stuff about your state right down to the municipal level.
Well, I respect you for doing that. Last question. So if you and I were to die tonight, I mean, you got to leave your message here. What are the three things that you would want people to know? Your whole life working on this, what are the sort of like the key things you want to leave with people as to what's important about UFOs, that sort of thing?
First thing, learn to quiet your mind, learn to meditate, take a class on meditation, read about the Maharishi effect. You want the world to change, learn how to meditate and help make it change. Because 10 people can change a lot. 100 people can change a lot more. 1,000 people can change a whole lot by meditating and causing a quietness zone, so to speak. That's one point. And this stuff is not hooey. Believe me, it's been documented. Okay. Also, if you really want to have connection to all that is out there in the universe, the aliens, whatever, be patient, but learn the skill, learn to quiet your mind. One does not become one with the universe with a cell phone in their hand. Shut the phone off and meditate 5 minutes a day. I tell my students, give me two minutes a day for the next couple of months. And then maybe we'll edge it up to 5 minutes. And then if you get good at that, maybe we'll edge it up to 5 minutes in the morning and 5 minutes at night. Okay. But take it up gradually. Be patient. You can't sit down and do an hour's worth of meditation. I'd rather have 5 good minutes of meditation than 45 minutes to an hour of struggling. And the lamas have been doing it since they were 7 years old. That's why they can do it for hours. Yeah. Okay. Best I ever mastered in the monastery was 45 minutes.
Is that right? Wow.
So, you know, and I'm being honest about 45 minutes. You know, a lot of people say, oh, an hour. No, 45 minutes about the best I can master. But I keep myself on an even keel with 5 minutes in the morning, 5 minutes around lunchtime, and about 5 minutes at night before bed.
Wow.
And I still get to touch everything. Okay. And the third thing, be kind.
There you go.
Be kind. There's a lot of meanness to people in the UFO community. Linda and I have been at the butt of it. And I'm a trans lady. Once upon a time, I was a boy person, you know.
Yeah.
And 30 years ago, I became who I am now. And there are people who say, well, you don't know what you are. I said, I know exactly what I am. Okay. I know exactly what I am. You don't know what I am. And if you can't deal with me and you can't deal with me and my wife, you'll never deal with ET.
Yeah, we are not the actor on the stage. We are playing an actor on the stage. That's what I was.
Thank you. That's a good quote. I like that quote.
I didn't know you were so much into consciousness. Well, I have to read your stuff. You've written a lot on consciousness because I think we'll have to have another conversation. That to me is.
Okay. The book to get. Okay. Is my book of columns. I published a book on Amazon. If you Google Cheryl Costa, Cheryl with a C, Costa with a C, in Amazon, and you go in there, there's a book written by me called The UFO Beat.
Okay.
I was a reporter and UFOs were my beat, you know.
Yep.
And I've got all 238 articles that I wrote in that book. Okay. And I wrote several about consciousness, more from the context of helping the CE5 people get some tips about really mastering their meditation. Don't eat a garlic pizza before you meditate. Don't eat onions. Don't have the onions either. You know, don't come in and start trying to do CE5 when you just came in off the expressway. You got to cool down, you know, this kind of stuff. You know, I hope to write actually probably over the next year or so, I hope to actually write something, a deeper book about consciousness, particularly in the context of touching those guys.
Yeah.
Okay. But I've been, I make a lot of notes. I got a lot of yellow sticky stuck in a folder, you know, the kind of thing. And one of these days it's all going to come out of here. It's just right now I'm busy trying to get the numbers down on paper.
Cheryl, has been an honor. Absolutely thrilled to, and I really want to do it again. So I'll get your book. I will go through it and we can maybe have some conversations because I didn't know you were into this. I mean, I've heard your all your data stuff and sightings and stuff. I didn't realize there was this other aspect, which is.
There's a couple of conferences that are about consciousness and I've tried to reach out to them. I said, guys, look, I'm a lifelong mystic here. I grew up in a family clairvoyance. Have me. Oh, you're a data person. We don't want you, you know?
Yeah. Well, there's still, even you mentioned this, be kind. There's still this sort of thing inside ufology and inside the parapsychology. We don't deal with UFOs or even people I'm interviewing, and it's like, well, you know, I'm doing parapsychology, I'm doing consciousness, I don't do UFOs. And it's this idea where there's still this division where, you know, we're fighting with each other or we have these set beliefs. We're in these little boxes, almost like academia, where you know, when you do the meditation thing or you start to, like Ray Hernandez, where you suddenly realize like, oh, it's all the same thing. And they actually tell them like, quit parsing this stuff. Then we start to move. But I guess it's up to you and I and other people to put it out. And, you know, when the time is right, people will catch on. I think we're better than we were. Because I remember in 2012, when I had the consciousness experience, nobody was talking about it. And there's a lot of people now, I make a joke, there's a lot of people like still the nuts and bolts, real, you know, into the disclosure and cover up and stuff, where even they're using the word. They have no clue what they're talking about, but they know you better use the word consciousness. So I think we've made some steps. I think we're moving in maybe slowly but surely we're moving along.
I'm one of my ordinations, I'm a priestess of Isis. I'm a nouveau Egyptian priestess.
Okay.
And I just initiated a class about 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
And they studied with me for a year. And this was hard because we couldn't do a live classes for 2020. Yeah. So we were doing it all online. And what we ended up having to do on the last day, I booked a public facility that we could have control over. It was a meeting facility.
Yeah.
And I booked it for 12 hours. And we got there at noon. We all brought our box lunch. I began doing what I called leveling lecture to kind of smooth out all the bumps from all the reading I gave online, the lectures I gave online, that kind of thing, Zoom meetings, that type of thing. And then we went through some of the physical motions of things that we had to learn how to do. But one of the points that I lost, we started out with 43 students, and I did a module back about, I'm going to say last November, where I gave them an introduction to UFOs from the continent. Heck, I showed them the pictures from, Nuremberg and Basel, Switzerland, and showed them a series of, I have a little briefing. It brings it up from biblical times to now, just a bunch of slides and saying this, and this. And I lost 10 students. Couldn't wrap their heads around it. They want to do the mystical stuff. They want to manifest stuff. They want to bend the reality with the mysticism, but they weren't willing to open up their mind enough to accept that there are the living entities out there. And we are swimming in the same consciousness they are. And I lost 10 students right after that talk.
Yeah. That doesn't surprise me, but it's we do what we can do. That's all we can do is, do what we have to do. And too much is given, much is expected, and knowledge not used is sin. It's like our idea that if we've got something, it's up to us to share it and have no expectation of where it's going to go. Live, or even Bashar, I don't know if you go into the Chandler stuff, but Bashar, live at your highest excitement and have no expectation of an outcome. And that's the way you got to live.
One of the things I've been telling some students, like even with the data,
yeah.
I said, it isn't pure mathematics. If I was just looking at the mathematics, it wouldn't work for me. There is an intuitive thing. Sometimes the numbers on a sheet of paper, a spreadsheet will sing to you a certain way if you're willing to open up to it. And then suddenly I've had to sit down and figure out, wow, now if I could just plot it like that, and in some cases I've learned how to do exactly that. How can I plot that data like I perceive now, and this book here, we've done some very interesting ways of plotting things. But the bottom line is, it takes a really open mind, and you've got to cut down on the Western chatter of all the minutiae that everybody thinks is important, and it's not. If you truly, really want a subject to study the subject of UFOs, start looking into the deeper Eastern views on things and start learning to quiet yourself, because once you quiet yourself, your own thinking processes take over. But two, as you quiet yourself, you start becoming aware of a bigger, one of my lamas used to say, the reason they can't see certain things that you can see is they have not made their view of reality elastic enough. Okay. And that is one of the biggest things I teach my students these days, is I'm trying to stretch your view of reality. There's using old Star Trek term, this is just a trumped up, tin plated piece of junk. This place is nothing but a big freaking illusion, and you're stuck in the freaking dream.
Beautiful, beautiful way to end it.
Anytime you want me.
Oh, I love it. I just thrilled by this interview. So thanks a lot. And whatever you want me to link, make sure you put it on there and we'll link it. And hopefully next year when we're on the ground, we can meet you in California.
Love to have a cup of coffee with you.
Have a cup of coffee and a donut.
Yep, you bet.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Grant. Bye-bye now.
Namaste.
Namaste.
That's this week's episode of the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. I'm your host, Grant Cameron, hoping that you will join me for upcoming episodes. Links to my YouTube interviews, books, and my Facebook sites are in the show notes. If you love the podcast or learn something valuable, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, or give a review on today's episode. If you would like a certain paranormal subject dealt with in the future, please let us know. Until next time, watch this space, and thank you so much for listening.